Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome two groups of high school students. Port Washington High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming. Please be seated. And we have students from Mount Horeb High School. Would they stand, please? And thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. This is a national award-winning program that we started in cooperation with the State Bar. And what we do is invite high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students agree to come, they are sent materials about the pending case, and they engage in activities centered around the case. They come, listen to oral argument, and then meet with a justice assigned for that day to meet with students. The discussion is on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. And everyone is invited to come for the discussion, including counsel. If there's anyone who wishes, we can give you a summary of the case you're about to hear. If you're not familiar with the case, a summary will help you. Does anyone need a summary? In light of that, none of you will get a summary. Let me introduce the court to you all before we begin. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. I'm going to introduce her twice because I forgot to introduce her this morning. So on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. You will meet with Justice Prosser after this case. Seated to my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to Justice Crooks' left is Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our second case for the day, 09 AP 1559, Peter S. Borst versus Mark Henn. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Borst is Attorney Vicki Zick. You have 25 minutes, Ms. Zick. You will be followed by Attorney Joe Thrasher for 30 minutes, and then you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning. If it please the court, I am Vicki Zick. I represent the petitioners, Peter and Kay Borst, in this case. The question we have put before this court is whether our doctrine of acquiescence, as we know it in the state of Wisconsin, contains a 20-year rule. More particularly, if after 20 years of mistaken belief in an incorrect boundary, the mistaken boundary becomes the legal boundary. I submit to all of you that it does not. And as you wrestle with the answer to that question, I would ask the court to keep this particularly important idea in mind. You must remember Wisconsin's law of adverse possession and how it developed in our state, which didn't develop the same as in all other states. In Wisconsin, very early on, as early as 1898, perhaps even earlier, although the Lampman case in 1898 said, purged the idea of hostile intent from our adverse possession law.
What case was that?
Lampman v. Alstein, 1898. It was reiterated eloquently by the Illinois steel cases right around the turn of the century, 1902, 03, several cases there.
Obig is the case in 1910 that oftentimes people point to for getting rid of the hostile intent. Right, but you have this case in 1898.
Yeah, are you talking Ovig v. Morrison is one of those? Yes, it's all kind of being hashed around at that time that our law of adverse possession doesn't contain any element of proof that your act of aggression was intentionally in knowing that you were possessing somebody else's property. That distinction explains why our law of our doctrine of acquiescence developed the way it did, because under our law of adverse possession, we've always been able to acquire property by mistake. People throughout history have believed that a fence line was the boundary when, in fact, it wasn't the boundary. But they never had to prove hostile intent. Mistake was enough, whether in good faith or bad, is what the court told us.
That wouldn't satisfy our current statute, though, which now governs adverse possession, which is 893.25.
Yes, it would, Your Honor.
Well, it says that the real estate is possessed adversely under this section, only if the person possessing it in connection with his or her predecessor's interest is in actual continued occupation under a claim of title exclusive of any other right and only to the extent that is actually occupied and protected by a substantial enclosure or cultivated and improved. So certainly you'd have to be making exclusive use of the property, which has to be adverse to somebody else who may hold it under title.
No question. You can hold it exclusively, but under a mistake of fact, which happens all the time in adverse possession cases. There's a fence maybe separating two farm fields. The neighbors think the fence is on the boundary line. They find out later it never was. Both parties are mistaken. And because our law of adverse possession allows for acquisition based on mistake, is why we don't see that being developed in our doctrine of acquiescence. Our doctrine of acquiescence is very old, goes back to, 1858, I think, in the Gove case, and it cites the three elements of proof, none of which had anything to do with a time period. You must have an uncertainty that can't be resolved by the deed. You must have a dispute about the line and an agreement to resolve the dispute. It's the agreement that the courts uphold. They're saying two people who don't know where their boundary line is can agree to fix a boundary line, and if they do, the court will uphold that agreement. Now, that explains why our doctrine of acquiescence doesn't involve this time period, whereas you may see that in other states. And I think you can say it's because their law of adverse possession is still wrestling with this hostile intent element. Because how do you get over hostile intent if the parties are only mistaken? And you can't. Here in Wisconsin, we've eliminated that. We've purged that element from adverse possession, which then, again, like I said, sort of helps us understand why our law doctrine of acquiescence developed the way it did.
Go ahead.
Counsel, I'm looking at paragraph 9 of the Court of Appeals opinion. Let me read what I'm focusing on, and if you are disadvantaged because you don't have it in front of you, please advise me. Well, it is that part. In paragraph 9, where the Court of Appeals, towards the end of the paragraph, says, as noted above, however, adverse possession requires adverse intent, an element not present when property owners are innocently mistaken about property boundaries. As a result, courts have developed the doctrine of acquiescence, which substitute mutual acquiescence for adverse or hostile intent. I interpreted these two sentences of the Court of Appeals opinion to be that the subjective intent being hostile is still the law for adverse possession. I disagree. I think that they're wrong based on virtually everything I see. But am I wrong in my interpretation? Or can you comment, if you will, about what the Court of Appeals in this case had to say about
good faith, bad faith, some of the cases refer to with regard to hostile intent.
I think the Court of Appeals in this case is reiterating exactly what's coming out of the Bouza case, which has troubled everybody for a very, very long time. This is exactly what Bouza says, that the doctrine of acquiescence is a supplement, and why it is a supplement. And Bouza never cited anything. They never told us where that logic came from. And all I can say based on my research is that if you go to the American Law Reports, et cetera, and you look at the doctrine of acquiescence and see how it's developed, in some other states, it has become a supplement to their law of adverse possession to overcome the hostile intent element. That was never the law here since at least 1898, 1900, 1902, and that's why it sticks out in Bouza. We all quote it when we talk about the doctrine of acquiescence, and I think we should just get rid of it once and for all because I don't think it's correct.
Does the Court of Appeals here appear to be suggesting to you that you need a subjective hostile intent in order to meet the adverse possession requirements in existence today?
I didn't read it that way. I think this paragraph 9 is just introducing the doctrine of acquiescence and more of that.
Okay, thank you.
Tell me the import of your argument. Okay, suppose I agree with you that there's no need for acquiescence. It's really a interesting antiquity in the law, and that this is all covered by adverse possession. Where does that get your client?
Well, I think it gets my client out of that 20-year problem that the Court of Appeals put him in, you know, because the Court of Appeals is saying, hey, if you're wrong for 20 years, too bad, so sad, you're going to lose your property. There is no 20-year rule in our doctrine of acquiescence. There need not be a 20-year rule because mistaken boundaries can allow you to acquire property under our adverse possession law. But the difference it makes, Chief Justice, is the fact that what plagued the Stoic Court, what in addition to a mistake must the adverse claimant show? And under our adverse possession law, you've got to actually occupy the property for 20 years. You've got to do it openly, visibly, continuously, exclusively, notoriously for 20 years. You can't just be wrong and nothing more than that. And that's what bothered the Stoic Court. You know, they're saying in that case where there was 29 years and the time period didn't make any difference, but the court was bothered in that case as to, well, what did you do other than be wrong? And the court says you had to actually do something more than just be wrong.
Don't you have to do something that fits with the nature of the property?
Yes.
So if it's hundreds of acres that we're talking about, a wilderness, you don't have to walk it every day.
Absolutely.
You don't have to fence it in. You have to show control over that property that fits with the nature of the property, right?
Absolutely, and that's what Oppermans in this case, the Hens and the Oppermans, did not do. They didn't bring a claim for adverse possession because they hadn't occupied the property.
Well, what do you mean by occupy? What kind of land is this?
This is hunting land.
Hunting land. So did they hunt on it?
I believe they did sporadically hunt on it.
Did they exclude others from hunting?
No, they did not.
But can they exclude others from hunting?
I think that they would have to. I think those are the facts we had in the Stoic case, very similar to the similar piece of property, some sporadic hunting, but not enough to put the true owner on notice that someone was occupying the property the record owner owned.
And not in the Stoic case, not in the relevant part of the property that was in contest. I mean, Judge Vergeron went through, okay, you're saying a few deer stands here, and but this isn't really the contested property, as I understood the Stoic opinion.
Right. And because this was not an adverse possession case, we never got into those kind of factual issues, whether the Oppermans did something or you know, did enough or whatever to put the Bursts on notice. You know, this isn't how this case came to the court because it started out as a survey case and kind of ended as a doctrine of acquiescence case.
Counsel, if you had the opportunity to write the majority opinion in this case, what would your elements, your stated elements of the doctrine of acquiescence be?
It would be uncertainty in the true line that cannot be resolved by looking at the deed. It would be a dispute about the true line between adjoining property owners. And three, an agreement to resolve the dispute, either express or implied. Okay? And then, if that happened, then the record owner would forever be estopped from asserting the true line when it was found. And I think you see that. You see that all over, but the cases don't come to court. You see two farmers who don't know where their boundary line is, and they really don't care because they've got hundreds of acres to farm. But they abide by a line fence, a boundary fence, not caring whether it was on the true line or not. They've tacitly agreed. They don't run out and get a surveyor and try to move the fence one way or the other. I think that's happened all the time. So really we have a lot more acquiescence going on in Wisconsin than maybe our courts realize, you know, because people acquiesce to wrong boundaries all the time and it doesn't matter. That's what our doctrine of acquiescence would do and should do and has done up until we got to this case. I mean, this is really the first case where we're saying, if you're wrong for 20 years, too bad, so sad, you just lost your property.
Counselor, I very much liked your brief and the way you developed the doctrine of acquiescence. It was very, very understandable and thorough. But I have a different problem with this case, and let me tell you what it is. The Boers sued to determine that the boundary line between Section 8 and 9 was Hen Road, right?
No. No.
It was not Hen Road. I'm sorry. It was not Hen Road. Thank you. It was not Hen Road. So they had the burden of proof of showing the court where the boundary line was, correct?
Correct.
Okay. But the trial court found in finding number 7 that neither party had shown by clear and convincing evidence where the actual boundary line exists. That's what the trial court found. Why doesn't this case just turn on a failure of proof by the Boers? Was their burden of proof, aside from all this stuff about the legal theory, you know, to me, I'm like Sergeant Friday. Just tell me what the facts are, ma'am. And
okay,
here I find the facts in the trial court's decision, a written decision. Since it's your burden of proof, trial court says you didn't prove it. Why isn't that the end of the case?
Well, and I think because what happened is the trial court, after hearing, you know, a full day of testimony from the surveyors, didn't know where the boundary line really was,
right,
and then invited further briefing on this doctrine of acquiescence. The briefs are filed, and then the court decides on the basis of that doctrine that the Boers lost their property, that Hen Road would be the boundary based on that doctrine. We appealed that finding because I argued that the doctrine of acquiescence didn't apply in this case based on Shandell because both parties had unambiguous deeds.
Yeah, but, you know, in his written decision, he goes into legal conclusions about acquiescence. But he makes a finding that nobody proved where the boundary was. And, I mean, that bothers me, you know, as an old trial lawyer before I became a judge. If you don't meet your burden of proof and you're the one that has it, the law follows along, but you got to first prove facts enough that if they're there, that you can prevail on the law.
And it might have been a much different case if the Honorable Judge Anderson had stopped there and just said, you know, you failed to meet your burden, I'm unconvinced, and
right,
and you lose. Right. But he went further and said, based on the doctrine, I'm going to say Hen Road is the boundary line.
Yeah. See, I like the exposition of acquiescence, and I think the court, however it comes out, can help the public a great deal and the lawyers and everyone else better understand how we view it and how we will be applying it. But when I look at that, that's very interesting. But I also look at who wins and who loses, because mm-hmm. that's part of our decision, regardless of how we explain that doctrine. And I frankly have trouble getting over the findings of fact, saying nobody showed them where the line was. Now, in your reply brief, I have another question. You brought up the monuments section, 60.84, and the certificates of record section, 5975, saying, well, there was a presumption that when Chandler filed the tie-in that the monument was back in the swamp, that's presumptively correct, and unless that's overcome, then his finding that nobody showed where it was is clearly erroneous. But, you know, that's not really been briefed or really argued by opposing counsel to us at all. Everybody's gotten off on the law, and nobody's talked to us about whether or not the trial court's finding was clearly erroneous given the statute which he has to operate, the uncontested facts about what Chandler did with the tie-in. So I'm having a little problems with this case, and it's on a real elementary level.
Yeah, well, I don't discount what you say, Your Honor, about that. But I guess it's explained by the fact that Judge Anderson really kind of blew past that point and went on to decide the case on the doctrine of acquiescence, which is where we took exception with, not necessarily that no one rebutted the county surveyor's statutory presumption correctness.
But do you think that makes his – I know you said in your rebuttal brief also, if the line falls down from where Chandler did the tie-in, then each party has 40 acres, which is what should be in the section. But do you think that makes the trial judge's finding clearly erroneous, that nobody proved where it was?
Yes, I would think in part it does make his determination erroneous. But the judge just didn't want to find where that corner section was. I mean, he just says that. That's not what this case is about, and I'm not going to go there.
No, he wants to decide the line that divides the party's property, and I agree that that's what you all were about. I agree with that. Okay,
Could I ask, how does the stipulation in 1917-18, how does that bear on this case?
That's an interesting question. I say it has no bearing. The stipulation obviously involved it's a north-south line, a dividing line that ran north and south, but it did hinge on the location of the section corner. But part of the problem with that stipulation is how does it filter down to subsequent owners? You know, the Burse weren't owners at the time, and the Oppermans weren't owners at the time. So how does that stipulation, I think it can only apply to those two property owners. I don't think it can impact the location of the corner, you know, the section corner where that's located. It might alter the boundary lines between a party to the north and one to the south, but it can't change that corner because how do the parties get notice where that corner is? See, the county surveyor wasn't found by that. At least he didn't feel he was. He believed the monument was found in 2005 in a swamp. He recorded a tie sheet, and that's where the corner is going to be, irrespective of this old case.
Go ahead. If I understand the facts of the case, you have a north-south highway coming up this way and then turning this way. Okay. And at the point where it stops going north and starts going west, right in the middle of the road there is the point where four sections come together. Or is that the right term? I think sections come together.
Right.
Okay, now the court has determined that.
Oh, you mean in that Vondersek case, the court has determined?
Yeah.
To an extent, yeah, but that case really wasn't about determining where that corner was located. That was based on a stipulation between the parties where the boundary line between them would be. And I think that goes to, Judge Rogensack's question about we have a statutory procedure for locating section corners, and no one's really followed it, either in the Vondersack case or this one. So right now it's still where the county surveyor says it is.
So none of the successors of the parties that were bound by that stipulation, none of the successors of those people are involved in this litigation?
No, they're not. And really, what we raised in the first raise at the trial court is if we were going to change that, the location of that section corner, you had, I think it was 64 separate property owners that really had to be involved in the case because they were going to be impacted by the outcome of that determination.
In 1918?
No.
Oh, in this
well,
case?
Well, probably in 1918 as well, but definitely when this case went to trial. If the court was going to move that section corner from where the county surveyor located.
If if you prevail here, what is the impact on all of the other property owners?
Well, as far as I know, Your Honor, it only impacts the boundary between the Burse and the Opperman, because we're just going to change the boundary to what to match up where the county surveyor put the section line. Mr. Northrop, who was initially a party in this case but didn't participate in the appeal, his boundary is always going to be Hen Road, so it'll be different. But I think the Court of Appeals got that part of the decision correct, that, you know, finding a boundary line between two properties is not the same as establishing a section corner. And the Court of Appeals reversed the trial court and said, no, it's going to be where the county surveyor has it.
Could I ask this question? We're talking about how many acres? What, 60?
40.
Oh, 40 altogether?
Oh, for my client.
Yeah.
For my client.
And that's woodland?
Yes.
Any buildings on the land?
No, not on the disputed land.
The Oppermans are the ones who would purportedly lose the land. Is that right?
No, they would gain, under the trial court's determination, they now have possession of 58 acres, and the Burse have possession of only 22. About 18 acres is involved.
32 acres, right?
Well, I'm bad at math.
Okay,
18 plus 22
right.
Equals 40. My client pointed that out. It's pretty embarrassing. But
you're right.
But they would only have 22 acres, not 32.
Yeah, you can hear me.
If you prevail, theoretically, if you were to prevail in this case and the losing party had built a house on the acres that are lost, would that affect the result?
It could have, and then it probably would have been an adverse possession case. You know, it would have been clean, crisp, outright adverse possession if the house stood for 20 years. But that's what makes this such an odd case, is nothing happened on the disputed acres for the 20-year period. People were just wrong about the boundary.
Now, have your clients been paying taxes on that land?
Theoretically, yes. They're paying taxes on a 40-acre piece of property that, unfortunately, has a roadway through it that divides it. But they're still paying taxes on all 40 acres because that's what their deed says they own. But they haven't been using anything west of the roadway.
Is there anything more at stake here than just who owns the 16 acres?
Well, not as to my clients, there's nothing more at stake. But as to the law, I think there's a lot at stake in terms of, you see this doctrine of acquiescence of showing up more frequently. And if we let it, if we let it stand as the Court of Appeals has let it stand right now, we don't even really need a law of adverse possession, because at least the adverse possessor has to prove up something. He has to prove up he did something with the disputed property. Under the way it is now, you don't have to prove up anything. You just have to be wrong. Walk into court and say, well, I was wrong about the boundary, so I get it. You know? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Thrasher.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, I am Joe Thrasher, counsel for respondents. What I would like to address is, first of all, what I think the case is really about, and that is the line of case law which provides that historic lines of occupation can and often do result in boundaries, not as to section lines, but title boundaries. Secondly, I will address what I see as the so-called 20-year rule and why the Court of Appeals was right, but it's probably irrelevant, and if time permits, the status of that so-called Parker survey. At the beginning, though, let me say three things. One, I want to dispel any thought that this is an adverse possession case. It is not. I wish it were, but it is not. Secondly, the parties are currently occupying the same lands that they and their predecessors in title have occupied for at least 120 years. And thirdly, as to the question about real estate taxes, historically they paid taxes on what they are now occupying. It was not until a letter from the tax department I think it's quoted at page 17 of our brief. Very recently, because of this discovery of a monument in a swamp, the tax lister has changed everybody's acreage, and generally everything in the area has been disrupted, all because of that piece of concrete. Now, to begin with, there is no question that there is a species of acquiescence which results in historic lines of occupation resulting in boundaries. A number of cases are quoted in our brief at pages 21 through 25. They are quoted and discussed in the petitioner's brief at pages 12 through 16. They're described by petitioners as survey cases. I'm not sure where that description comes from. But there's no point in, I won't sit here and quote them all. It's all done in the briefs. And clearly, in many cases, historic lines of occupation have overcome even brand new surveys. In this case, we don't have a brand new survey, so in a sense, this is even stronger. The problem is, what do we call those types of decisions? Mostly, the term acquiescence has been used, perhaps unfortunately. I think the problem with that term is, no matter what form of title transfer by lapse of time we have, be it adverse possession, be it a prescriptive easement, or be it the classic form of acquiescence, it all involves somebody acquiescing in something. And thus, I think there's a tendency to confuse the word as a descriptive word with a legal doctrine. Well, in our brief, I had called it a principle of common usage, because that's what Albert Simpson, our surveying expert, called it. And that's a term that is used in Brown's treatise on boundary control, acknowledged by the petitioner's experts in this case to be authoritative. But in the reply brief, and I must confess with chagrin, I didn't tumble to this until after our brief was on file. But in the reply brief, the petitioners denied that there was such a concept, and yet I looked at the cases again, and clearly they're there, and it was done. The lines of occupation prevailed in numerous cases. So I did what I probably should have done earlier, and that was start thumbing through the index to Clark on surveying and boundaries, and found the term practical location. Everybody had been focusing in on the term acquiescence, I think, in their research. When I ran the term practical location through Westlaw, boom, there it is. In not too many Wisconsin cases, but some. And in numerous decisions in other states. That is simply a term given to the concept that if not only neighbors, but the neighborhood goes by long-standing lines of occupation, be it roads, fences, what have you, that will eventually prevail over any other survey, and that is what is now being referred to as boundary by practical location. The leading cases on this form of acquiescence, which are discussed in our briefs, either don't use that term at all, or have used it in a sense that it sounded like they were describing what someone had done as opposed to the name of a legal doctrine. But there are other cases that recognize it as a doctrine. To the extent that I may be permitted to refer to something not in the brief, I assure the Court the citations have been furnished to counsel. And a case of this Court, which I really commend, not because of its facts particularly, because of what it said, is Lawler against Brennan, 150 Wisconsin 115. It was actually a case involving the location of a road, and most of the Wisconsin cases that use that term do seem to involve locating roads or lots within plats as opposed to 40-acre parcels. But the principle should be the same. Lawler states, among other things, the principle, meaning of practical location, is very familiar, that resurveys of ancient lines by courses and distances, paying no attention to ancient occupation, is not a satisfactory method of arriving at the line. It has been correctly said that such surveys are entitled to little weight as against practical location of the line by fences or by occupation for a long series of years. The court went on to point out that the principle applies to highways as well as lands and gives the reason for it as follows. It is a beneficent principle in that it makes for repose and settlement of rights rather than for the reopening of acrimonious and expensive disputes with every new survey. It is a correct principle in that in the majority of instances it doubtless reaches results more nearly in accordance with the original survey than any other method. And with that, I heartily concur. The facts of this case cry out for application of that type of doctrine. We have at least 120 years of people treating those roads as section lines and ordering their lives accordingly.
But isn't your opposing counsel, Ms. Zick, saying that's just not true? That it seemed to be no man's land, that neither one of the neighbors occupied the land. They didn't hunt that particular land. They didn't cultivate that particular land.
They owned it. Oh, I think they
That's
probably
That's the issue
hunted.
In the case.
They hunted it, some, I'm sure. I don't think that they occupied it for 20 years in the sense that would entitle them to adverse possession.
That's why
I've
you
never
did
claimed
not,
that.
That's why you didn't claim that.
Well, actually, I think my predecessor did,
but
I withdrew that claim.
I understand that.
I agree. But, it's not adverse possession.
Okay, but for practical location, you think there was enough occupancy here?
Yes, but we look beyond the immediate owners in that situation.
I understand that.
We're dealing with at least 2 and possibly 3 miles of road. In the letters that I quote on page 17 of the brief, when the county wrote the landowner saying we're changing what you own, it says that 6 sections are affected. That's either 2 or possibly 3 miles of roadway. I don't recall whether there's a road between sections 6 and 7. But there are at least 2 miles of it, and 120 years of use were disrupted because the county surveyor insisted on that monument being not only the section corner, but also the boundaries. There is a difference.
With regard to Hen Road, arguably between section 8 and 9, north and west, is that portion of the road going rather north and south 2 to 3 miles? Is that in the record?
No. The mileage I'm talking about is north-south Hen Road for a mile,
okay,
east-west for a mile, and then in the letter to the landowners, the county included the 2 sections west of that.
Okay.
What I don't recall is whether there's a road between those.
I mean, it's just talking about a section. A section is a square mile. Yeah,
right.
That's right. Okay.
So at least parts of 6 square miles are affected. It's not just 2 little 40s.
And did the trial court make a finding that it was the customary usage? I know the trial court used that customary usage in addition to acquiescence. For all of the property owners along Hen Road?
It made the finding that everybody has treated it as such, yes. Does that bind other owners? No. But the fact of what other people do, and I would say the fact of the Von Dressick lawsuits, is not to bind these 240s, but rather is just part of the total evidentiary package that goes to a finding of, as the trial court said, acquiescence, which I think is more appropriately called boundary by practical location.
Counsel, did you have an opportunity to review the amicus brief that was filed yesterday in this case?
Yes. And no, it's not an adverse possession case. But
well, usually I ask the questions, but that's okay. Not always. I'm flexible. If I may, they set out 4 categories of acquiescence. Now, your response to my question, or
your response was it's not an adverse possession case. So fit that into the discussion, if you will, of the four categories of various acquiescence theories. Their category, first category, is, they say, the kind of case where we have here today that requires a statutory time period. Another acquiescence case, this kind or genre, if you will, is of mutual agreement that falls short of the 20-year period. Another type of acquiescence case, and they cite all these cases, they're grouping them, is the common grantor case. And, of course, common grantor has by lot and transfer the property, and it's ambiguous. And then there's the fourth theory also, which they say seems to be the theory that the petitioner is asking this court to follow. Do you agree with this kind of a categorization of the acquiescence cases, which everyone seems to agree are confusing? You said, well, the one thing I agree with my opposing counsel, they're confusing. And your opposing counsel set forth survey cases and set forth other cases, and she says, adverse possession cases, to add to the confusion, and the next heading is, to add to the confusion, so got a lot of confusion here. So does this grouping work?
Not unless I can add a fifth, and that is where you have numerous people in the neighborhood for many, many years treating certain articles, in this case a road, as boundaries to the point where you do have a boundary by practical location. Most of these categories assume a black acre versus white acre situation. And technically, that's what it is. It's only one owner suing another owner. But the important facts go beyond their boundary. They go up and down at least 2 miles of roadway and over a century of public usage and treatment and taxation and what have you. So I'm okay with these categories as long as we don't say they're exclusive.
Well, in your category, then, this, for me, new label of practical location, how many years?
That brings us to the so-called 20-year thing, I think, Your Honor. And we have to look at what the Court of Appeals really said there. I think they're right, but I don't know that it was necessary to go there. We've got to go back to this case in the Court of Appeals. There, more than here, petitioners pushed the notion that an unambiguous deed trumps acquiescence, period, and relied primarily on language in the Bouza case, although we both have serious problems with that case, but more on Shandell against Excellent Farms in the Court of Appeals. And I do kind of commend the decision in that case as outlining the history here. And historically, acquiescence, no matter which breed of acquiescence you want to talk about, did require 20 years before title would vest, just like adverse possession. And there's good reason for that. I mean, they are simply related ways of title transferring from one person to another due to the occupancy by a non-true owner and acquiescence in that by the true owner. So it makes sense they would be the same period of time because they serve the same policy. But if you read Shandell's history, somewhere along the line, this court started to craft exceptions into the 20-year requirements. And one of those was where there's uncertainty as to the location and there's an agreement between the parties. There is where Shandell said, that's all well and good. That's an exception to the 20-year requirement. Unless, given the facts of Shandell, unless there's an unambiguous deed and no dispute about where the true line lies, then we're not going to let you off the hook with less than 20 years. And my reading of Chantel is that all it said is that the exception to the 20-year requirement will not apply with an unambiguous deed and a known true line on the ground, which has no similarity to our case whatsoever. The Court of Appeals, then, is correct as a logical extension of what Chandel and the cases it talks about says is, yes, there will be a 20-year acquiescence regardless, but the exception won't apply, shortening the 20 years, if you have an unambiguous deed and a known line in the ground. That's all it says, according to my reading of it, and that's what makes it irrelevant. The Court of Appeals was right, but here we have not 20 years, we have 120 years. We have a different form of acquiescence, which, again, I think the term practical location makes a lot of sense, and we don't have a line on the ground. And that's the 20-year rule as I see it. It's got nothing to do with this. It's merely where an exception to the 20-year requirement doesn't apply. So that's a long answer to get to 20 years.
Could I ask, I think you are requesting that the court buy into the theory boundary by practical location. Is that right?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay. And whoever, suppose we agreed to that, what are the elements of that that you have to show?
I think this court has probably said it best in the numerous cases we have talked about. And I'm looking for where that is. Well, basically, 21 through 25 of our brief, Wolman against Rule, for instance, says that long acquiescence in the line so established with undisputed for such a long period of time raises a strong presumption that the line so recognized is the true line and is not overcome by the mere fact that a survey made long after government monuments have obliterated or lost reveals another line. More to the point, though, I think, is Rosen against Eiler, also discussed at page 22 of our brief, because there they focused not just on the short boundary between the parties, but on an entire section line offenses and historic occupancy. It's that type of thing. Here we have an absolute classic case of people having lived in accordance with lines of occupation for 120 years. That's how long that road had been there before this lawsuit was filed. And the court's findings of fact on that subject are unassailable, and nobody ever tried to challenge them. That's what everyone lived by. Now, that brings us to the question, I think.
I want to stay with Justice Prosser's question. What are the elements? So you said in response, long acquiescence, undisputed.
At least 20 years.
And at least 20 years? Is that the element also?
I think so.
I'm asking you.
Assuming you don't have one of the exception-type cases that's discussed in Chandel, and
Chandel,
I'm not claiming
and Beasley
that.
And a lot of other cases, the exception for the common grantor,
right.
The exception for the agreement.
Right. There I can be sure.
Those are different. Those are not 20-year cases. Okay.
That's right,
so
and they're not this case.
For this practical location, your elements are long acquiescence, undisputed, and then you said something about 20 years. Is that your definition of long acquiescence?
Yes, that would be a minimum, I would think.
So long acquiescence for a minimum of 20 years and undisputed are your elements for this practical location.
I think that makes sense.
How does that differ from the Court of Appeals in Stuck or Stoic, S-T-E-U-C-K, which was decided and published just this last spring. And in that opinion, with regard to the doctrine of acquiescence, if it is assumed that it remains a distinct doctrine, in paragraph 38, it sets up elements and then it applies it in its concluding paragraphs 41 and 42. And the elements are visible activities, at least 20 years, no objection, plus a commonly understood, I'd say, line of demarcation, commonly understood boundary. How does the elements of your practical location vary from those elements in what I think is the most recent published case in this state that discusses the doctrine of acquiescence?
I would only point out that that, again, was Blackacre versus Whiteacre, a single line being in dispute. I don't really question how they phrase it. I just think we have to recognize that in this broader form of acquiescence, we also look to, may I call it, community activities. What does everyone else do? That's an addition in this type of case, an additional factor that simply isn't present there. I'm quite familiar with that, having consulted with counsel for Stuck, the brief writing in it. Finally, though, I would like to address the Parker survey, because from the reply brief, it seems quite evident that petitioners take the position that it's still good, it's a good survey, it's there, it's real, and I take complete issue with that. We have to go back and look at the history. And we also have to keep in mind that the present survey is based entirely on the Parker survey. It's not new work done by Carlson, the county surveyor. The government survey was performed in 1858. Less than 30 years later, the road was laid out, and there is in the record a crude sort of survey showing the northern terminus of North-South Hen Road to be at a section corner. We have the road built, and then in 1907, a number of corners can no longer be found, so the town of Butternut commissioned the county surveyor, Parker, to relocate a number of section corners, not just the one involved here. Beyond question, he did it wrong the first time in one way. I suggest he did it wrong in two ways. The conceded thing he did wrong was, once he decided to treat the corners as lost, as opposed to obliterated, he should have used mathematically what's known as the double proportionate method. He used the single proportionate method, which is used for locating quarter corners, not section corners. The town got on him to the point where he finally went out and redid something. In 1911, he presented another plat to the town. The town did not accept it. The town was the commissioning authority. It never accepted that plat. It was set aside, temporarily rejected by the annual town meeting of 1911, and there its history ceases as far as the town record is concerned. But the next year, a phantom document, I will call it, purporting to be a survey, somehow got recorded. It bears the name of Parker, but no signature. There are in the record before this court not only that survey, but a number of other Parker surveys, and nobody is going to dispute this one is in a different hand. It was recorded, and nothing ever came of it again, until 2005, when surveyor Patrick Beale, for other reasons, was slogging around in a swamp and found a concrete monument. For reasons best known to him, the county surveyor seized upon that, said, that's Parker's. Parker must have done it right, and I'm decreeing that this is the corner. He recorded a tie sheet, but the county didn't stop there. All kinds of disruption ensued when they started writing people saying, we're changing your boundaries, we're changing your taxes, we're changing everything else. Well, the Parker survey failed to comply with statutory standards at the time in two respects. There are no field notes and there is no signature, requirements which persist to this day, but these statutes are annexed to our brief in an appendix. Now, in 2008, we have a trial and we have findings of fact by the court that clearly reject that survey. Justice Rogensack is quite correct. A plaintiff in a case like this has the burden to prove the validity of their own title. They can't rest on the weakness of their opponents. And that title depends entirely on the validity of the Parker survey. And in finding of fact number 3, Judge Anderson said, this court is not satisfied that the resetting of the corners in 1912 was correct, and there is not clear to convincing evidence to substantiate the original monument or any subsequent reset. There's nothing to fall back on here. If this court were for some reason to reverse, that doesn't automatically give plaintiffs what they ask. To my way of thinking, it sends it right back to the circuit court, and we're back at square one. And then we'd relitigate the survey issues, I suppose.
But
because
how can you relitigate something that was made as a finding of fact after a trial? I don't understand.
Well,
that. If it's clearly erroneous, you still don't relitigate it. You just obliterate the finding. But if there's a finding and there's not clearly erroneous, then I don't know how you get around the findings. That's my problem with this case, is very elementary.
Well, I don't think you do get around the findings, and I don't think this court should or will reverse. I'm speaking in those hypotheticals. What if? But I merely point out that we shouldn't assume that that Parker survey is on the ground and would control but for this long-term acquiescence. No, that's not the case. I think that that thing is invalid for reasons of law. It failed to comply with statutes and based upon Judge Anderson's finding of fact. So what we are urging this court to do is, yes, affirm the Court of Appeals with or without its discussion of this 20-year thing, because that's not necessary for the multiple reasons I've discussed, and simply affirm.
Yeah, I think that I disagree with you a little bit, and that I do think it is necessary for us to address the 20-year rule set out by the Court of Appeals if we're going to try to write an opinion that clarifies a number of the nuances of the law of acquiescence.
Yes, and I concur with that because it's a published opinion.
Right,
obviously.
Exactly.
But I think that it is easily explained, as I've tried to explain it under Shondell, that the norm for acquiescence of any form is 20 years. The Court of Appeals was simply saying, well, an exception doesn't, in Shondell was saying an exception doesn't apply, but there's no case of which I'm aware that says that after 20 years, an unambiguous deed trumps acquiescence, even in the appropriate case, and this is not the appropriate case for that anyway. Thank you.
Well, how a deed may be unambiguous in what it states. I can think of a number of deeds that would be absolutely unambiguous, but then when you try to find that area on the land,
precisely,
it is not there.
And that's the other reason why that whole discussion about the 20-year thing may have been unnecessary, but I agree with Justice Rogensack that it's there in a published opinion. It probably should be addressed.
A couple of key points. As you can tell, Attorney Thrasher is upset that the trial court did not determine, based on the survey evidence, where this section corner was located. Blew past it, decided this case on the basis of the doctrine of acquiescence. But you need to keep in mind, out of the cases that he mentioned, we have acquiescence as evidence in many cases, in many survey cases. The treatises that guide surveyors say, Yes, surveyors go out and look at where the fences are being placed, et cetera, because the monuments are long lost. So what evidence do we have of their first initial location could be tree lines, fence lines, et cetera. So acquiescence in these cases are acquiescence's evidence. The parties are acquiescing in a line that could be a representation of the true line back when the monument still existed. That doesn't make them a doctrine of acquiescence case. This case is decided on the basis of the doctrine of acquiescence, which is far different than acquiescence's evidence, which Mr. Thrasher wanted the trial court to do, to tell me where that section corner is located.
Counsel, I want to go back to the Stoic case that you made reference to earlier in your comments. And I asked your opposing counsel about the elements set forth in that case in discussing the doctrine of acquiescence, that is the visible activity, 20 years, no objection, plus a commonly understood enclosure or line of demarcation. Do you think the Stoic discussion is incorrect? I think the answer is yes, but I mean, I'll let you answer it. What do you think about those three elements for the doctrine of acquiescence? Are we to follow this most recent law regarding the doctrine of acquiescence?
No, you should follow me, Your Honor.
I parenthetically said I knew what your answer was going to be. I just didn't know it was going to be that bold.
The doctrine of acquiescence has three elements: uncertainty, a dispute, and an agreement.
Stoic disagrees with you.
No, Stoic follows me. There is no 20-year rule in Stoic. They blew right past that. There was 29 years of mistaken belief in Stoic, and the court doesn't even mention it. So there is no 20-year rule. Stoic agrees with me. It maybe didn't focus on the elements. What Stoic was hung up on is what did the Stoics do to put easily on notice that there was a boundary dispute. How could he acquiesce in something he didn't even know there was a dispute about?
The element in the Stoic case that they got from the Menzner case and a couple of other cases that were cited, I forget, the term is visible activity. You need visible activity. You need it for a 20-year requirement. No objection, commonly known enclosure or line of demarcation.
Yeah, like I said, I don't think there was a 20-year element in Stoic, but they were definitely looking for something that the claimant had to do something to at least show that the neighbor was acquiescing in the activity, you know, or acquiescing in the boundary. And Stoic didn't quite find that. Stoic is more an adverse possession case. You know, they discuss the doctrine of acquiescence to an extent, but it's really about adverse possession. The other thing I want to point out before I'm finished is the Pickett case as an exception. Go back and read Nagel. That's where this comes from, the Nagel case, 1957, which starts out kind of as an acquiescence case, looks at the doctrine. It says Pickett is an exception to the 20-year rule. Untrue. Pickett is not an exception. Pickett was a straight-up doctrine of acquiescence case where we had dispute or uncertainty, a dispute, and an agreement. It wasn't – the reason it was less than 20 years is because the agreement was found. And that's what I argue to you folks is if you have an agreement, it doesn't matter how many years transpire. The agreement is the agreement. So Nagel misunderstood the significance of the Pickett cases. There's two of them, and both of them are straight-up doctrine of acquiescence cases with three elements where the time doesn't matter. The first time that the time element factors in, I think, is 1902 in the Peters case, and we never see it again till 1957 in Schimmel and a year later in Nagel. And that's where it kind of gets a little bit mixed up. There is just no 20-year element in Wisconsin's doctrine of acquiescence. It's just not there. It shows up a little bit in there, and then it flourishes in our case here. where the court just comes out without citation to any authority and says, after 20 years of mistaken belief, you lose your property. And that's what we rebelled on. Thank you.
Thank you, Zick, and thank you, Mr. Crasher, for your interesting arguments on what might very well be a Property 101 case in the law school, dating back to historic principles in the disputes. So we conclude our case of 2009 AP 001559, and the students will remain here and will be joined by other students in and you two may remain also if you wish. The court is in recess until 1:30, when we will hear our third case for the day.